Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk. No nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
March 11th, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, criminal defense attorney in Manhattan, New York City, the Big Apple, broadcasting to you live from just east of the Freedom Tower here in Lower Manhattan. I am very excited about today's show. As our listeners know, this show seeks to entertain, educate, and include our listeners in the important legal issues of the day. This is an interactive show. We want to hear from you. You can email the show at talkinlaw@gmail.com. Remember, no G in talkin, talkinlaw@gmail.com. Please like our Facebook page to get all our latest show updates at facebook.com/talkinlaw. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, HOCHHEISER. And please go check out our prior episodes at blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw or on iTunes. And I would appreciate it if you listen on iTunes, if you would leave us a quick review. That helps us out. Our last two shows were selected among Blog Talk Radio's Today's Best on the Blog Talk homepage. Those two shows featured George Anastasia and John Alit concerning Mr. Anastasia's new book, Gotti's Rules, a very interesting couple of shows about the mafia. If you're interested in the evolution of the American mafia, I highly recommend you go to blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw or iTunes and check out those prior shows. What are we going to do today? Today we're going to have a great guest who I will give a proper introduction to in a moment. We will then go to the question of the day. Beth Karras will join us for the latest updates on Jody Arias and perhaps the Eitan Patz case. We'll answer the question of the day, and that's a show. So, without further ado, let me introduce our guest. Sidney Powell is an attorney. She served in the Department of Justice for 10 years, has handled hundreds of federal appeals as a private attorney over the course of the past 20 years. Powell is the author of Licensed to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice. This excellent book is available at www.licensedtolie.com or at your local bookstore. Without further ado, Sidney Powell, are you with me?
Good morning, Dan, and good morning, New York.
Good morning, and I want to give you a public applause for your book, Licensed to Lie. Unfortunately, I didn't get the book until Monday, but since Monday, in all my spare time, I haven't been able to put it down. It reads like a combination of a John Grisham novel and a Bob Woodward expose. It's fantastic. You pull no punches, and congratulations on the book.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate it. I did try to write it like a legal thriller, and it is one, but it's true.
And as I'm reading it, and right now I'm on page 276 out of about 400 pages, and it's hard to remember that it's true, and the allegations in it are shocking. Let's start off with a little bit about your background. Tell us a little bit about your current law practice and, a brief history of your legal career.
My legal specialty is federal appeals and complex commercial litigation. I've done over 500 federal appeals, primarily in the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. I was an assistant United States attorney for almost 10 years in three different districts across the country, being the chief of the appellate section in two large districts in Texas, and also a prosecutor in the Eastern District of New York. I worked under nine different United States attorneys from both political parties. And so I was especially shocked to encounter the significant prosecutorial misconduct I encountered approximately 13 years ago now when I began representing one of the Merrill Lynch executives in the Enron or Nigerian barge litigation.
Where are you practicing now?
Dallas.
You're in Dallas. Are you also practicing
Yes.
in North Carolina?
I have a place in North Carolina, but my practice is only federal, and I'm not in North Carolina very often anymore.
I see. Very good. Well, let's start with the beginning of the book. The book starts out with just a great, not great, it's very sad, but it really draws you in immediately. You have this former prosecutor, Nicholas Marsh, who is the subject of the first event in the book. Tell us who Nicholas Marsh was and why you began the book with a description of his suicide.
Nicholas Marsh was a federal prosecutor in the Department of Justice in the Public Integrity Section. He was the leader of a Department of Justice task force called Operation Polar Pen that was investigating public corruption in Alaska. Team wound up indicting, actually led by then acting Assistant Attorney General Matthew Friedrich, indicted United States Senator Ted Stevens, the longest serving Republican in the United States Senate, on what they claimed were basically public corruption charges, not reporting the amount of gifts accurately on his Senate ethics form. Marsh. Marsh got second chaired from the original position on the prosecution team, and the trial lead trial counsel was Brenda Morris. But between them all, they actually hid evidence that showed Stevens was innocent, and hid significant evidence that would have impeached the government's key witnesses against him so badly that after Stevens was convicted and lost his Senate seat by only a few thousand votes, Judge Sullivan was irate. I mean, the government was making more and more, quote, mistakes of different kinds throughout the trial, to the point where Judge Sullivan would make them disclose more every time they got caught in a lie. And every time they disclosed more, they got caught in more lies. He wound up dismissing the indictment and appointing a special prosecutor to investigate the Department of Justice and the Public Integrity Section lawyers who had prosecuted the case. Marsh was one of those lawyers, and the evidence against him was piling up. He wound up committing suicide in just a gruesome and tragic incident. And the other prosecutors actually still work in the department.
Now, let me take one step back. What did you hope to accomplish by writing this particular book, License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice?
I wanted people to feel the damage that prosecutorial misconduct takes on everyone, including those who commit it. And that's why I started the book with the suicide of Nicholas Marsh. I call that chapter The Ultimate Toll. Whether Nicholas Marsh actually did anything wrong or not, and I'm sure there are people on both sides of that issue, it was far too great and ridiculous a price to pay for him to commit suicide because of the investigation being turned on him. But it also demonstrates the huge toll being the subject of any sort of federal investigation takes on anyone. And I wanted people to feel that.
How did you become involved personally as an attorney in the corruption which you allege was ongoing at the Department of Justice through the Enron scandal, et cetera?
I had been consulting on the Arthur Anderson case as a result of it being in the Fifth Circuit, and then a partner of one of the lawyers in the Anderson case happened to be a friend of one of the Merrill Lynch defendants in the Enron litigation, and gave me a call one day to see if I would talk to his friend about his case. So I became lead counsel for Jim Brown, one of the Merrill Lynch executives who had done or participated in the Nigerian barge transaction, and then wound up in 10 years of litigation almost representing him. And I didn't even start until the first trial was over.
And what was wrong with the Jim Brown prosecution?
Everything from the indictment through the jury instructions. As soon as I read the indictment, which I had to do repeatedly, I could not find a crime, an actual crime in the indictment that was consistent with anything I had knew or ever heard of. So I started researching that immediately and realized that the indictment itself was unprecedented. There literally was not another case in the country that supported the charges that were brought against the four Merrill Lynch executives. They were charged with conspiring to defraud Enron of the honest services of Andrew Fastow, which would be laughable were it not for the fact four Merrill Lynch executives spent a year in prison on an indictment that really didn't state a criminal offense, while the prosecutors, it turns out, I learned 6 years later, had actually yellow highlighted the evidence that showed these defendants were innocent, that directly contradicted the government's witnesses and documents, that directly contradicted 16 statements they made to the jury in closing argument alone. And they hid that evidence for 6 years while these men went to prison.
You're listening to Talkin' Law with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Sidney Powell, federal appellate attorney and author of License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice. Sidney, so Jim Brown is really an egregious case that you describe in the book. It's really a horror for him and his whole family, this former Merrill Lynch executive who was indicted and then had at least the transaction involving Enron. Those crimes were ultimately reversed and dismissed, I believe, but he suffered greatly, as did his family. Let's talk about who were the actual prosecutors who hid this evidence.
Well, that was the ultimate insult and unfortunate development. The prosecutors who yellow highlighted and hid the evidence that showed he was innocent were Catherine Rumler, who became White House Obama's longest-serving White House counsel, Matthew Friedrich, who became the acting attorney general for the criminal division of the Department of Justice and then micromanaged the corrupted prosecution of Ted Stevens, and the supervisor of both of them at the time, who sat in the courtroom almost every day and had interviewed the witnesses in the grand jury, was Andrew Weissman, who became general counsel deputy director of the FBI and is now head of the corporate fraud section of the Department of Justice. Bill Hodes, Bill Hodes, one of the leading legal ethics experts in the country, co-author of Hazard and Hodes, filed grievances against all three of them, and the grievances were just very poorly handled. The one filed in Texas against Friedrich bounced like a rubber ball. The one against Weissman, ironically enough, was defended by the Department of Justice in the New York bar. And then the New York bar punted it in the middle of the night behind our backs to OPR, Department of Justice, to decide the grievance. Well, you don't have to struggle too long to think how that came out. Needless to say, they found no grievable offense against Mr. Weissman, no problem at all. So then he went from general counsel at the FBI over to NYU as a senior fellow, and now he's back at the department.
But
and Catherine Rumler's just kind of turned to dust.
Judge Sullivan, who was the trial judge for Jim Brown's trial, is that correct?
No, Sullivan was the trial judge for Stevens' trial. Ewing Werlein in Houston was the judge for Jim Brown's trial.
So Sullivan, who is the trial judge for the for Senator Stevens' trial, he opened an investigation into prosecutorial misconduct, hiding Brady material, which is exculpatory evidence or favorable information for the defense. What was the result of that investigation?
That investigation produced a 500-page report authored by Hank Schulke and his partner Bill Shields, and they found intentional and systematic misconduct within the public integrity section and the Department of Justice in the Stevens prosecution. We couldn't get any such attention from Judge Werlein in the Houston case, and one of the things the book exemplifies is what a difference a federal judge can make, one who's willing to have a healthy dose of skepticism and hold the government to their burden versus one who simply lets the Enron task force run the courtroom.
And you talk a lot about Judge Werlein in the book, and if I didn't realize that I was reading a true account of things that actually happened, I would think I was reading a book of fiction in which the author had created a judge who was sort of a composite of about 100 judges I've appeared before in the past, a judge who just goes along with whatever the prosecution argues, who really acts as sort of a second prosecutor in the courtroom, and it really makes it very unfair for the defense. What are your thoughts on Judge Werlein, and is he still on the bench?
He is still on the bench, as far as I know. You'll have even more of an opinion of him before you, by the time you get to the end of the book, and I don't think it's going to be a good one. There were times when I saw glimmers of hope from him, but those were quickly dissipated.
And let me go back to Judge Sullivan, who was the trial judge for Senator Stevens' trial. He appointed this really like a special prosecutor, and they produced this 500-page report. And what happened with this report? Anything?
Oh, this gets worse, too. The Department of Justice, of course, had to do its own report. OPR conducted that investigation, but mind you, that was only because Judge Sullivan was doing his. And OPR issued or recommended sanctions against two of the line assistant U.S. attorneys, basically only because they had admitted they knew some information was Brady. They had raised the question repeatedly, but their views of producing it had been disregarded, and they'd been told to forget it. Nothing happened to their superiors, nothing at all. In fact, Brenda Morris, the lead trial attorney, went on, I think she's assistant general counsel at Booz Allen now, Matthew Friedrich and Rita Glavin, who the report reveals, told the prosecutors to play discovery close to the vest and play hardball, and specifically instructed them not to get the file from the Anchorage Police Department that would implicate one of the witnesses, the key witness, in all kinds of sordid, horrible misconduct, including subornation of perjury. Of course, Friedrich and Glavin dispute that, but there was significant evidence in the report that I would encourage people to read for themselves, that they had directed a lot of that conduct. They certainly directed everything else in the trial, from where people sat at counsel table to who could ask what when, and scripted the arguments. So they were micromanaging it to the nth detail, but they're both, I think Friedrich is now assistant general counsel at Chevron after doing a short stint with David Boies's firm and another stint at Freshfields. And Glavin, I don't remember who she's with now, but she's in private practice.
And you're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Sidney Powell, author of License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice. You can get this book, which is shocking and a must read, at www.licensetolie.com. Sidney, let's talk a little bit about Arthur Anderson. What I was shocked by upon reading the book, and, you know, as you read press accounts, you sort of know things, but I don't think you really internalize them until you read them in a narrative as you put together. And it's really unbelievable that Arthur Andersen, one of the big five accounting firms at the time, was indicted, was prosecuted, convicted, went bankrupt because of the prosecution. 85,000 people lost their jobs, and then ultimately the Supreme Court said Arthur Andersen hadn't committed a crime at all. What
right.
happened to those prosecutors who prosecuted that case, wasted the taxpayers' money, and cost 85,000 people their jobs?
Well, that's Leslie Caldwell, who now heads the Department of Justice Criminal Division. She's Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice, and the subject of an article I did in the New York Observer at observer.com called War on Wall Street. And Andrew Weissman back, she brought him back as her head of the fraud section, and he was one of the Andersen prosecutors. And also Matthew Friedrich was one of the Andersen prosecutors. So it was basically the same team prosecuted and destroyed Andersen that then turned their sights on Merrill Lynch and tried to destroy it and or the individuals involved. You know, once they indicted Andersen, they destroyed Andersen. They knew it was going to be the death penalty for Andersen as soon as they publicized the indictment. So they actually sealed the indictment for a week while the SEC worked behind the scenes to, quote, avoid upheaval in the markets, end quote, because Andersen represented 2,500 publicly traded companies, and you can't have an accountant under criminal indictment who represents publicly traded companies. So they knew exactly what they were doing, and they did it to send a message to any other company that might that they might want to knock on the door of, that you better cooperate with us and give us everything we demand, or you're going to be destroyed, with no regard
now
to the 85,000 people in their jobs or the history of this venerable accounting firm.
Now, let's talk about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas a bit. In your book, you make several references to Justice Thomas not asking any questions during oral arguments before the Supreme Court, and he is famous for that. I believe he's asked maybe one question since he's been on the bench all these years. What are your thoughts on Clarence Thomas sitting at oral argument time and time and time and time again and remaining silent?
I think that's simply his personal style. He apparently views most of the questions as meaningless, or feels like he learns enough from the questions of others that he doesn't need to ask any himself. I guess he decides things, you know, based primarily on the record and the law, and I've never really studied his decisions particularly to know how he comes out on things, but that's his style. Yeah, like you said, he's famous for never asking a question. The others certainly make up for it, though.
Well, Justice Thomas actually is known as a very right-wing conservative justice, a strict constructionist like Antonin Scalia. However, a lot of people don't realize that Justice Thomas has actually been on the correct side from a defense lawyer's point of view on several sentencing decisions, ensuring that people are not punished for crimes that are not decided by a jury. But I really just have to wonder, after I read your book and consider it, whether we don't have a right to Supreme Court justices who really are engaged in the oral arguments. And I just don't see how you're engaged in the oral arguments if you sit there mute.
I think it depends on the judge. I mean, I've had judges at arguments who've been quiet because they already knew what they were going to do, or, you know, different reasons for different folks at different times. But it is unusual, I think, to have a Supreme Court justice who almost never asks a question.
Now, there's another Supreme Court judge who plays a role in the book when she was the Solicitor General, which is the top attorney for the government who argues the government's position in the Supreme Court. That's Judge Alana Kagan. What role did Judge Kagan, then Solicitor Kagan, play in the events described in your book?
She was Solicitor General during the arguments of the Honest Services cases before the Supreme Court, as I recall. And I was just appalled that the Solicitor General's office was making the arguments that they were making, trying to support the prosecution of the Merrill Lynch defendants in this case for deprivation of honest services, a crime that has always involved bribery, kickbacks, or some form of significant self-dealing, because these defendants didn't take a dime from anyone. The judge, as he sent them to prison, even acknowledged they were just doing their jobs. And there was no bribery, no kickbacks, no self-dealing of any sort. But I'm also aware of a case now in the out of the Second Circuit, out of Loretta Lynch's office, involving a defendant by the name of Bradley Stinn, who's been in prison for 6 years for drawing his salary as CEO of Friedman's Jewelers on a similar fraud indictment. And it's just absolutely outrageous. He got a 12-year sentence when he didn't take a dime from anyone.
Well, that's interesting. In our system of justice, which I often have trouble explaining to clients, is really difficult to explain. Last week on my show, we had John Alite, who was a former enforcer for the Gambino crime family, for John Gotti Jr. and others, and he said in the show that he was involved in 37 shootings, several murders, 100 baseball battings and stabbings, and he did a total of 14 years in prison. So, you know, clients ask us questions as defense lawyers about, you know, how we can reconcile these outcomes for different cases, and I have yet to be successful in doing that.
We have a serious problem in our criminal justice system, and one of the things I'm working very strongly for now is criminal justice reform, because we have a serious problem of overcriminalization, outrageous abuse of prosecutorial discretion, judges who are either phoning it in or making decisions based on their own personal animosities. And that's just not acceptable. We need to have a much more better system of fundamental fairness to all, so that there are not these egregious disparities.
Well,
and I'm not sure the sentencing guidelines helped with anything. I mean, the prosecutors just rack up more charges if you don't plead guilty, and lots of innocent people plead guilty. Judge Rakoff even wrote an article within the last 6 months or so on why innocent people plead guilty. That's an excellent article I would commend to everyone.
Yeah, I did read it, and I agree with you. And if there's anything I can do to help in your efforts to seek criminal justice reform, please reach out to me and let me know. What can be done about these repeated instances of prosecutorial misconduct, including hiding evidence from the defense that they're entitled to, giving discovery to the defense at the 11th hour, and basically conducting trials by ambush? What can we do about this? I haven't seen any solutions in the works, and I'm not sure I know the answer to how to combat this abuse.
Well, I think soon we can expect introduction of legislation in Congress and a bipartisan effort to create open file discovery in the federal system, something akin to the Fairness and Disclosure of Evidence Act that Senator Murkowski spearheaded the efforts behind back in March 2012 upon the release of the Stevens Report. That was widely supported by everyone from the ACLU to the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Ironically enough, it was only the Department of Justice who opposed that legislation, and it died in committee. But I don't think it's going to get the same have the same problem this time. I think people have seen enough. Judge Kaczynski, of course, who wrote the foreword to my book, has talked about it across the country and even from the bench. Senator Orrin Hatch held up my book in the hearings for Loretta Lynch a few weeks ago. urged her to read it and to clean up the Department of Justice. I'm afraid that's falling on deaf ears, given the whole tone of this Department of Justice and the increasing politicization and weaponization of every agency in the department. But I still have a lot of hope, and we'll continue working toward all aspects of criminal justice reform. There's also an order on my website, licensedtolie.com, a Brady compliance order. And if every state and federal judge would enter that order at the beginning of a case and enforce it, it puts teeth in the Brady rule. It solves the problem that Judge Sullivan had in the Stevens case because he hadn't entered a formal order. That's why the special prosecutor found that the lawyers could not be held in contempt per se. So I drafted a Brady compliance order that is quite rigorous, but I think fully warranted. And everyone can use that and file motions requesting that it be entered at the beginning of every state and federal criminal case. And I think we could start making some better law on that issue. That's what Department of Justice does. It stretches the law beyond comprehension and tries to make law to circumvent Congress in all these criminal prosecutions where they are simply taking already broad language and making it even broader, like the Brad Stinn case.
Sidney Powell, thank you so much. We are out of time. Thanks for coming on the show. I urge everybody to read Sidney Powell's License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice, available at www.licensedtolie.com or at your local bookstore. Sidney, thanks again.
Thank you, Dan. I should warn, though, it's not at local bookstores. Barnes & Noble won't carry it, and the New York Times wouldn't review it, but it is available on Amazon.
Well, that's just a testament to the corruption of the powers that be, which is further evidence of the accuracy of this book. Thank you, and I applaud you.
Thank you very much, Dan. I appreciate your help.
Take care now. Now we go, before we get to Beth Karras, we go to the question of the day. The question of the day is, what amendment to the United States Constitution protects the accused's right to effective conflict-free counsel who has an undivided loyalty to the accused? But first, give me Beth Karras.
What can
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
Good morning, Beth.
Good morning, Dan.
How's New York treating you?
Well, it's great to be home. You see, I brought the warm weather with me.
Well, thank you for that. The snow is melting. I am feeling better. I sort of feel a hint of baseball season coming, so I think things are moving in the right direction here.
Right. You know, having just left Phoenix, the local news, all the sports stories were all about spring training. I guess there's a lot of spring training in the Phoenix area. True?
And in Florida and other places which are nicer to be in than New York. But we're in New York. And
yeah.
I'm glad you're back. Jodi Arias. Now, Beth, I really thought that once you left Arizona, we were sort of going to have a break from this drama, but we don't, and we have news to talk about.
No, there's something new every day. Whether it's Sheriff Joe Arpaio issuing a press release curbing Jody's rights in jail because she's still in his custody until she is sentenced to life, which is going to happen on April 13th. Maybe it'll change. I'm not convinced it'll happen on the 13th, and then she'll go into state custody. So Jodi Arias gets a life sentence because the jury deadlocked a week ago tomorrow on whether she should live or die. And that one holdout we haven't talked about, you know, it was 11-1 for death. This holdout, it turns out, was investigated during the course of the trial. We just got a decision from the judge yesterday afternoon. She released it, describing what happened during the deliberation process, which took 5 days. On day six in the morning on Thursday last week, the mistrial was granted. And two mistrials, by the way, two deadlocks in a row, the benefit, it defaults to the defendant. The benefit goes to the defendant. She gets a life sentence. No do-over, no third trial for a penalty phase. Well, the state wanted to bounce that juror, and the other 11 jurors were having a problem with the holdout because they said she wasn't deliberating, that she was, you know, basically locked down. You know, she wasn't listening to them. The juror had sent a note to the judge saying, I'm being bullied, they're putting pictures in front of me, which jurors who gave a press conference later admitted to doing. They were putting the picture, the graphic autopsy photos in front of this woman, trying to convince her, you know, she could get out, look what she did, you know, to convince her to give death. And she said, that, you know, death is revenge for them, and it's not for me. And she just was... she just wasn't going to budge, and it really frustrated the others. It was so fascinating to read about the hearing behind closed doors, and the judge could not find cause because the juror did deliberate. She was considering the options, and it's considered coercive to bounce a juror, obviously, when the judge didn't know the vote was 11-1, but courts have held that it's improper and to bounce a juror in deliberation. Fife Symington in the late 1990s, for example, got convicted when the court bounced a holdout, and it was 11-1 for conviction, and that was overturned by the Ninth Circuit. He got a presidential pardon before he was retried. But there are other cases that say you got to be really careful in determining whether or not a juror is not deliberating and somehow obstructing the process, or is just holding firm to his or her beliefs and interpretation of the evidence. So the judge didn't find misconduct on the part of the juror. But the state is now investigating the juror because her ex-husband was prosecuted by the same prosecutor who handled Jody Arias' case, because they want to see if maybe she was asked specific enough questions that she didn't disclose recognizing him or knowing him.
Now, there's another investigation, if I'm not mistaken, Beth, going on into how the holdout juror's information identity was disclosed in the press. Is that correct?
Yes. There's an official court document which lists the names of all the jurors, including their middle names, and only six copies were distributed to some court personnel, to each side, prosecution, defense. When I was waiting for the press conference, close to midday last Thursday, for all 11 jurors and some alternates came down to talk. All of the people who wanted death came down, not the holdout. And it was on the ground floor of the courthouse, and the courtroom was on the fifth floor. So I'm waiting there, and I saw a Facebook post another person in the media got outing the holdout. And I never said her name. And I looked up her Facebook page, which was easy to find because her name was a little distinctive, and I could ID the photos, the woman I had been looking at for 4 months. And I knew it was the juror. And on her Facebook page, for anyone who wasn't even a friend, because she hadn't put privacy settings on things, you know, you could see her likes, she had liked things that would have or should have been a red flag to the prosecution if they had checked. And the prosecution hadn't checked until deliberation, because he raised the Facebook page during deliberation. And it was likes of, like, you know, Laws of Attraction and The Secret, which were Jody Arias things, which came up during the trial. Jody Arias believed these things. And it showed perhaps an alliance with Jody Arias, but the state could have found these things if the state had looked at her Facebook page. I'm looking at that. And then within an hour or two, well, after the press conference, a screenshot of all the juror names, including those 11 who voted for death, was released and posted, you know, somewhere on that, like, Jody Arias fan page. And so the court's looking into the release of all of them because it's limited to the people who had access in the courtroom. So one could say, well, maybe the prosecution released the holdout to maybe the family or some supporters of Travis Alexander, the victim, and then the other side retaliated. I'm just saying, I have no idea who released the names.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Beth Karas, KarasOnCrime.com, about the Jody Arias post-sentence verdict drama. Now, Beth, my last question for you before we leave each other for today is, do we know if juror number 17, this holdout juror, was or is a subscriber to KarisOnCrime.com?
I don't know. I know her likes are Nancy Grace, though, so she could be a subscriber. In fact, I will check. I can go on the back end and search for her name. I don't know. I doubt it. She shouldn't be. She shouldn't have been during the trial, but I'd love her to be now.
Okay, well, you'll let us know. Anyway, Beth Karis, KarisOnCrime.com. Beth, glad you're back in New York. Speak soon.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Bye. Okay, now we go to the answer to the question of the day. The question of the day is, what amendment to the United States Constitution protects the accused's right to effective conflict-free counsel who has an undivided loyalty to the accused? The answer is, the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution provides for the right of an accused in a criminal proceeding to assistance of counsel, which the courts have interpreted to mean effective assistance of counsel. To be effective, under most circumstances, an attorney must have an undivided loyalty to the client. An attorney who is representing multiple defendants in the same case, or an attorney who himself is under investigation by the same prosecutor prosecuting his client, may have a conflict of interest running afoul of the Sixth Amendment. In the situation of multiple representation, an attorney may fail to serve the best interests of one client by efforts made not to hurt another client. This is particularly true in the case in which one attorney represents two defendants with inconsistent defenses in the same case. While an attorney under investigation by the prosecutor prosecuting his client may divide his loyalty between his client and his interest in currying favor with the prosecutor to avoid criminal liability himself, in New York State, these types of conflicts are generally resolved by what we refer to as Gomberg hearings, after a case which can be found at 38 New York 2nd 307, or in the federal courts by Curcio hearings, which can be found at 680 F 2nd 881. Some attorney conflicts are subject to waiver by the client, while others are not. As soon as counsel becomes aware of a conflict of interest or a potential conflict of interest, my opinion is the attorney should raise the issue with the client and the court at the earliest opportunity in order to ensure that the client's Sixth Amendment right to assistance of counsel is preserved. Now, I want to thank Sidney Powell, author, License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice. You must get your copy at www.licensedtolie.com. I think it's an outrage that Barnes & Noble won't carry this book. I think it's also an outrage that the New York Times won't review it. The book is excellent. As I said earlier, it is a cross between a John Grisham novel and a Bob Woodward expose. It is true crime, but it reads like fiction. It's a page-turner, and you must read it to understand what is going on with your federal government and its Department of Justice. I want to thank Beth Karis, KarisOnCrime.com, my producer Mark Goldman, who does a great job every show. Thank you, Mark. Email me at talkinlaw@gmail.com. Tell me your thoughts about the show. Suggest guests. I want to hear from you. Listen to our prior shows on iTunes. Leave us a review. Like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinlaw. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, HOCHHEISER. We will have our next show next Wednesday, 9:30 a.m. I wish everybody peace and justice. Go read License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, signing off. Take care.